Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. It wasn't a casualty of the pandemic in the true sense, but one of the things that I was looking forward to every year, and I haven't done since the pandemic happened, was I was in this sort of writer's group or mastermind. And this group was, you know, it was people like James Clear, Shane Parrish, who does Farnham Street, Steve Kam, who does Nerd Fitness, Eric Barker from Barking Up the Wrong Tree. I won't list everyone, but it was a great group. And one of my favorite people in that group was Tim Urban. And, you know, the pandemic happened, so we couldn't do it for a year. And then some of us had kids and we got busy and we just fell out of the habit. And I do hope we get back into it. But today's episode was the longest conversation I've got to have with Tim since we would spend 3 or 4 days in this house in Arizona and just give each other feedback, kick around ideas, have long dinners. So it really felt like an awesome throwback, and you get to listen to this one. Tim is a fascinating dude, way smarter than me. He's got a bachelor's from Harvard. He graduated magna cum laude, started an SAT tutoring company that was super successful. Like, the idea that you'd be so good at the SATs, you could teach other people how to be good at them, it's incomprehensible to me. You've probably seen a million of his super viral blog posts and articles over the years. Actually, I was just talking to Paul Rabel, the great lacrosse player I'm working on this project with, and he was like, have you ever seen that woolly mammoth post from Tim Urban and Wait But Why? And we ended up having a big conversation about my favorite post from Tim. There's this one about, like, all the potential future options are available to you, that, like, the past is limited, but the future has this unlimited potential. That's one of my absolute favorite ones. But my real favorite one from him is this apple theory about how there's the skin, the fruit, and the core of the apple. And some people, the skin's not so good. They've got this sort of rough exterior, but the fruit is good and the core is good. Some people, the fruit's okay, but the core is rotten. Some are rotten all the way through. It's a great example, I think, of what makes Tim such a smart thinker and an interesting dude. He just thinks about stuff differently, and he manages to express it, articulate it, illustrate it in a way that really sticks with you, that makes you think about things differently, that opens you up to something. And he talks about science, he talks about AI, he talks about space, but my favorite stuff is when he's talking about procrastination, about the writing process, about making stuff, about trying to get better as a person. That's what we ended up spending most of this episode about. When he got off, he was like, you know what? Thanks for talking about it that way. Because his book is a bit controversial. His book is called What's Our Problem? A Self-Help Book for Societies. It's available only as an ebook on most major platforms and an audiobook. It's not up as a print book yet, but it's brilliant, provocative. I don't agree with all of it. Not what I expected from Tim, but it's, as always, you know, well done, and a lot to chew on. So we don't talk about the book too much here. If you've listened to Tim on other podcasts talking about the book, this is me talking to one of my favorite people, one of the most interesting people writing out there in the world. And I think you're really going to like it. You can check out the book at waitbutwhy.com. You can follow him on Instagram at Tim Urban. You can follow him on Twitter at waitbutwhy. You can check out What's Our Problem? A Self-Help Book for Societies. Anywhere you get your audiobooks or your ebooks. And you'll see, I think, in this episode, why that book took him 6 years, his peculiar vices and virtues when it comes to creativity, and as always, his unique way of thinking about this. So here is my conversation with Tim Urban, who I hope to see in person one of these days very, very soon. Enjoy. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. How old is the baby?
The baby is 7 weeks old.
Oh, man. Well, good timing with the book launch. That was smart.
Yes. No, so hilariously, she was supposed to come like 2 weeks after the book launch. And I was like, okay, I'll have 2 weeks to like get my shit together and process everything and like do my promo. You know, I'll do all my podcasts. And then she came the day after book launch, as it turns out. So kind of, yeah. So it was, I had one night in between these two projects.
Well, I was thinking of you. I heard this expression. The expression is, a writer is someone to whom writing does not come easy. And I thought that that is the perfect description of you.
There you go. That is definitely me. I don't know if anything that like I supposedly care about, once it's actually the thing I'm supposed to do, I don't think anything has come easy. Like I always like, I'm doing one activity, you know, one activity. And then I think I'm procrastinating on that activity with some other passion. And I'm like, oh, that's what I should be doing. And as soon as that's what I'm supposed to be doing, it becomes not easy.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like any of it is easy for you. It seems like it's hard to be Tim Urban in a very sort of first world privileged, like nice way. It doesn't seem like it's easy to be Tim Urban.
My goal is, and I'll report back on this, but I'm doing another book now and I'm starting my own podcast and I'm like, I have a bunch of new projects, which I've been dying to start, but I've been stuck in this other book for a while. And I'm trying to reconfigure my life in a way that it isn't hard to be Tim Urban. It's nice to be Tim Urban, where it's like, this is fun.
Why is it so hard to be Tim Urban? What gets in the way?
You know, it's a combination of it's like there's some muscle that people like you have, somehow you got it, I don't know where, and I don't have that muscle where you can just make a grown-up plan for yourself with no external person telling you have to do it. There's no teacher saying you have to be in class at this time, and there's no parent saying that, and you don't have a deadline. And you just do it because it's the right thing to do, because it's the selfishly right thing to do. It's what you've chosen it makes sense to do it. And that muscle for me is, I just resist that usually. So procrastination, maybe perfectionism, you know, these are kind of two sides of the same coin. But I will say that I also am someone who believes in growth. I think it's like very easy when you've been some way for your whole life or when you're stuck in a long time habit to just think this is just to give up and say, this is just, that's just who I am. And, yeah. And I don't, and I don't believe that actually, because habits are just kind of, it's the automated software running in your head. And if you can train it differently, like a dumb dog. And so I'm using this transition period to try to like actively make some very like obvious changes and, you know, do better.
So to mix metaphors, you're broken, but you're not fixed.
I would say I'm broken, but I'm fixable.
Well, that's what I mean. So you're not fixed, like a growth or a fixed mindset, right? Are you capable of change?
Not fixed. Yes. Not that kind of fixed. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Exactly. Okay. You were being more clever than I realized. Yes. I'm broken, yes. but I'm not fixed. Yeah. I just think about it. Humans are so plastic. I mean, think about humans who have had to, you know, my wife's parents grew up in Iran, and that's where they thought they were going to live their whole lives. And they had family and life and careers there. And then they had to suddenly in 1979 move to the US where they didn't speak. It's like people can make giant, massive adjustments, and we are survival machines, right? And so it's like it's there's no reason I can't make some tiny, much easier life adjustment at any point in my life. I'm very convinced about that.
So is the muscle that's not there for you, is it not there for you in all things, or is it only in certain kinds of things?
It's there in the category of things where A, it is the thing I'm supposed to be doing. It's the job. It's not the procrastination from the job. If I'll be working on one thing and then suddenly I get excited about doing this chart showing how long, you know, history has been, and I'll spend four deep focused hours doing it and then tweet it out, right? And because it's not the thing I was supposed to be doing. So A, it has to be the thing I'm supposed to be doing, and B, it has to be something where no one else is involved. There's no other. If I have a collaborator, I'm much better about this. If I'm working with someone, it's a much better situation. You know, it's really when I'm really left to my own devices. And so then this other part of me kicks in. That's like, ooh, this is hard though. Let's do it in a few minutes. You know, let's just not right now, not this exact moment. And then that goes on for 5 hours. You know, or I'll. You know, I'll get into research that I'm supposed to be doing, but I'll like then go way too far with it and end up watching like an hour and a half YouTube video about it that I really shouldn't be, but it's interesting. And, you know, so there's a lot of like kind of compulsive parts of my personality that I think like take over. But it's, you know, and it's a source of misery. It's like when I'm in better and more control of that, I'm like much, you know, and that's why for me having shorter deadlines, like having weekly blog posts was actually a good match for me, or doing like a weekly podcast, because then the misery is contained. I'll be miserable for 3 days. I panic monster comes in. I go and freak out and finish it. And now I'm so happy and so relieved. And it was all worth it. When I publish something, it's always all worth it. Oh my God, this is so gratifying. And I'm so happy it's done. And I'm so proud of this now. So the goal is to just try to like change that equation a little to, I think it's a part of it. Again, it's this delusion where, we our mutual friend Nir Eyal, right? He and I would co-work together, and Nir is very productive. He writes a book, and then he writes another book, and then he writes another book, and he also has a child, and he's very, you know, he gets stuff done. And I work with him, and we write for 45 minutes, and he's like, okay, that's a good day, and he stops, or maybe he'll be like, oh, let's do a long one. He'll work for an hour and a half, and then he's like, okay, good long day. And I'm thinking that I'm going to write for 8 hours today. But if I actually add up the time when I'm deep focused writing, it's probably less than Nir is actually deep focused writing. So it's this delusion that you can do more than everyone else, and actually, and you end up doing less than everyone else. And so, like, just accepting reality, which is like, A, I'm not going to do more than 2 hours of deep focused writing on an average day. That's just not realistic. And B, that's a lot. If I just do that, it seems like it's too good to be true. I can just do 2 hours. It's like, no, there's some kind of like, you know, masochistic thing. That's like, no, yeah. That's not hard enough work. You know, you have to, you know, and so it's just, yeah. So it's a kind of a double delusion there.
Yeah. Someone emailed me once and they said something about how we always seem to underestimate the power of consistent but average like contributions or results. And so I think people would be shocked to hear that a writer might only work for 45 minutes or an hour a day, because they also buy into the idea of you know, 8 hours or, you know, marathon sessions. But that can't be done consistently very well or very often. And meanwhile, if you work 45 minutes a day every day for a lot of days in a row, that actually does add up very quickly. Whatever writing or
tortoise in the hair activity.
Yes,
a writer should be a tortoise. Like if you think about it, you're trying to drive. If doing a book is driving from New York to LA, it's like if you actually think of it, if I want to spend, you know, 300 total days of work on this, which is like a little over a year of weekdays. Yes. Okay, 3,000 miles. I got to go 10 miles a day. And the problem is for someone who, if it's a very grown up thing to realize that I'm going from mile 340 to 350 today. And that is a success of a day. And that's the unit of a finished book in 1 year, right? But when I was writing short, you know, one week blog posts, there was this adrenaline where the thing I'm writing right now is going to be seen by all my readers in 2 days. And it's going to be so exciting. And I can't wait to see what people think of this. And the adrenaline, it's like, this is, you know, it's like the dumb part of your brain, the kind of instant gratification, kind of unconscious primitive part of your brain. It thinks that, can see the end there. And it's like, oh yeah, okay, I'm excited too. But when you're going from mile 340 to 350 out of 3,000, that dumb part of your brain can't see LA, can't even understand that LA is going to happen. It just sees this isn't exciting. Nothing new. My life won't be any different at the end of this workday. And so it can be very hard to actually, you know, that's where the resistance comes in. Like, what's the point even of going from 10 miles in this minute? Sure. It's like, it just feels so hopeless, but of course it's not.
Yeah. I find, the other thing about, so like, let's say you're working on a singular blog post, something you're going to publish in a few days. Not only is there the validation, but there's also the sense of mastery or confidence that comes from like, you have the whole thing more or less in your head, right? You're like, you can imagine it. It's a small, even if it's a 10,000 word blog post, you're doing it in short enough time and it's contained enough that you're like, I know everything that I think about this. Whereas a book or any kind of longer project, like starting a company, you don't know all the twists and turns of that road. It's impossible for you to have it all in your head at one time. And so the sort of fortitude to sit with the fact that actually all I know are the 10 miles in front of me, and the sort of intellectual humility to stick solely with that, it takes a lot of discipline. It's easier to just do a lot of self-contained smaller things than to work on a component piece of a larger whole.
Yeah, because if you every day could be team up and be one big brain, they could see the whole thing and they could see the whole project. But you're in one little slice, and that's why you have to basically, there's a lot of self-trust. It's like the dumb part of your brain that needs instant gratification and is not going to get it from, you know, this random Tuesday of work, needs to learn to trust like the smart part of your brain that understands that this is a big project and it will come together in the end. And there needs to be some kind of like, yeah, like just like ceding of the authority to that part of your brain, which is what procrastinators have a hard time doing. They are just, you know, they're at the whim of this instant gratification monkey, as I would call it. Like, but it's, but you know, all you have to do is just, I, you know, again, I'm great at giving advice to others. Like I can, you know, I just don't follow it myself very well, but that's what I would say to like a writer. I would say the difference between, like, so just say there's two wannabe authors and they've never written, neither one's written a book. And then one starts just really, you know, light, just doing, you know, so let's say one page 3 days a week. So 4 days does nothing. 3 days, you know, wakes up in the morning, pulls their laptop on their bed and types for a half hour or an hour before they, you know, or maybe 2 hours before they get up and brush their teeth and do their thing, right? And the other wannabe writer is just like that writer, except it doesn't do the 3 pages a week because it thinks, oh, it's hopeless. You know, what's the point of doing a page? I don't even know. So it's like, actually, and there's 112 waking hours in the week. The wannabe writer has all 112. the person who writes 3 pages a week, maybe they have 106 or 108 of those. And that's almost the same, right? They're living almost the same exact week, except flash 2 years later, and there's a 300-page book, a 300-page manuscript, and there's nothing. And it's like, you know, once you realize that, it's just like the idea that, you know, it's this idea that things compile over time, but it's just not intuitive. You know, our brains aren't really wired to think that way, to understand that. Because think about it, you know, what we're wired for being in a tribe sometime a long time ago. You just didn't have slow annual projects. That's not how it really worked. I mean, maybe you're building a new hut and that's, but it's like you can see it in front of you and you're desperate and there's panic and like, you know, so you have to do some overriding of our intuition.
You know, the other, obviously writing is one place you can talk about this, but the other place where this, where our sort of minds obviously fail us in this regard is like saving for retirement. Ramit, who we both know, talks about this a lot. You just have to make pretty consistent automatic transfers or deposits in an account that captures the, you know, the sort of compounding returns of the stock market. You don't have to save that much money for that long for it to start to get very powerful very quickly, but we're not good at it. We delay getting started, and then every year that we delay getting started, or every dollar that we don't contribute that we could have contributed because we did something else we weren't supposed to do, or we, you know, thought of a get rich quick scheme or something, you know, it actually moves the goalpost further out of view, makes it less likely that we'll actually get where we want to go.
That's a double whammy too, because you have the time component of, you know, investing a little now for what long far away, which is not intuitive. There's another not intuitive thing there, which is compound growth. We are not wired to understand to think exponentially, right? I mean, again, someone in 20,000 BC, there was really nothing exponential in their life. Everything was linear, right? So they think in straight lines. And of course, today in an advanced civilization, there's exponential curves all over the place. And we are so bad at internalizing that. You have to kind of override our linear mind to see the power of that and to understand you know, how that works. So when you do a book, because you do books, I mean,
this is true for
every time,
audience.
Yeah. Yes, that's true too. It's, you know, it's like getting your first 10,000 followers, getting your first 1,000 followers on Twitter is like each order of magnitude is an equal step. Getting from 1,000 to 10 is as hard as the first. Getting to 100, getting to 1,000,000, getting to when you get to 1,000, you're actually like, in some ways, you're like you've done one of the four steps on the way to, you know, 1,000,000 or whatever. You know, it doesn't feel like that at the time. Because again, you're thinking linearly, but it's really more logarithmic in this case. And a lot of people give up in that first thing before the hockey stick takes off, because they're projecting, they're extrapolating the linear curve from where they're going, and it doesn't look very good.
Yeah, you have to, when they talk about like trusting the process, right? Like whether it's trusting the process of retirement or trusting the process of mastering a skill or trusting the process of, you know, turning around a sports franchise. I don't think we're good at comprehending how much trust is actually required, right? Because there is that early period where you're doing all the stuff right and you're gaining one follower a day, or you saw the interest in your account, you know, you got a $2.75 interest payment. You're like, this is never going to get me to the point where I don't have to worry about money anymore. Or on a book, you're like, I worked all day and I am one page closer. Like, I can't do this, you know? But it's really the ability to sort of suspend disbelief, to leap into the dark and to hand yourself over to some process that people before you have been through. I think that's the main thing. Like, people who have the ability to trust a process are going to be people who can take advantage of that process. But if you are ultimately cynical, or as you were saying earlier, like if you don't believe you're capable of change, like deep down you don't think it will work, you're probably not going to commit to said process to a level that actually lets you take advantage of it. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy in that regard.
The also, it's it's not even quite as simple as like, oh, you made one page of progress, or, you know, you gained this much money. Because sometimes you lose money, you know, in the stock market, it goes down, or you write a bunch of pages and you realize sure. that the whole last 20 pages, and I'm cutting it. I don't like where I've been going with this. And the point is, again, if you zoom out, what you see is a stock market chart, both with your writing and whatever, it's going to go up and then it's going to go down, but it's going to go up over time. And so again, people really give up on those little downswings. And that's, you know, there's all, you know, so much of life is a broadly upward moving stock chart that has lots of downs along the way. And it's hard not to lose your nerve in those downs, because the dumb part of our brain truly can't see more than 3 feet ahead of you. So you have to be able to, and you lose a lot of motivation. You know, it's very demotivating in those moments. And that trust in the process, I mean, I think once you've seen it work once, it's easier to work to have it, you know, trust it again. But a lot of, especially people who have never really, they've never been able to get themselves to do a big project. There's just no confidence in a process. And it's, you know, somehow you have to, David has to beat Goliath in that first time to see it work. And then they can at least give you that faith. Because, you know, you said the words deep down, you don't believe, right? And I think that self-fulfilling prophecies are very real. And it's like if you consider these two characters in your brain, the kind of rational character that knows about exponential curves and understands that it's a process and wants to have good work ethic. And then the other part of your brain that can see 2 feet in front of you and needs gratification and needs adrenaline to do anything or panic. And it's almost like you're not either of those. They're like in a gladiator pit, you know, battling, and you're a spectator and you're watching. And it's like who you believe is going to win, you know, if you could bet who you're truly betting on with a rational bet, that gives that character so much strength in your mind. And that's where your confidence is. So your confidence is that I'm confident that the monkey's going to win. And I'm not confident that I'm going to do what I want to do. That monkey just got like Popeye spinach, you know, and it's like on steroids. And so that's why it's you have to somehow have David beat Goliath a few times. And now the better the observer in the stands actually starts to think, I'm not sure it's a smart bet to bet on the monkey. They've lost 3 times in a row. I might bet on the other guy. And that's like, whoa, that's a totally different like self-image. Your whole storyline is different in your head right now. And so,
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic. I've said this before, I say I don't believe in myself, I have evidence.
Yes, right. But to get evidence in the first place is kind of a catch-22. It can be, so you are the opposite, right? You, every time I finished like a page of the book, you had another book out, okay? And it was like one page for me and one book for you. And I just in general, I've seen you do your thing where you'll like, we'll have like, you know, you'll have 15 minutes in between two things and you'll just like open the laptop and knock out some edits in your book. And for me, it's like, you know, perfectionism. I'm like, no, I need like a 5-hour clear window with every single thing perfect, right? Of course, which is not a grown up way to think about it. So were you always like that? Or did you like grow into that person?
Well, you know, it's funny. We always look at the people that are wired or act differently than us, and we think that it's somehow better, even though it comes with its own demons, right? Like I remember one time I was in my swimming pool with my wife. We didn't have kids yet, but I was in the pool. And we'd just gotten in, and all of a sudden I'm like swimming around, like looking at, there's something about it that was bothering me. Like I thought it was broken, or I thought we could fix this thing. And then I was like, do you want to swim laps? And she was like, you know, we could just be in the pool. She was like, we could just be in the water. We don't have to like do anything. And so for me, it's usually the opposite problem, which is, I think I do. I think there's a certain part of me that's always been sort of wired towards doing stuff. And obviously that becomes self-fulfilling and you get momentum and then you believe in the process and it works. And it, you know, it's a virtuous circle. But the vicious part of it is it makes it hard for you to not do stuff because you understand that not doing stuff there's an opportunity cost, right, to not doing stuff or to not taking advantage of every moment or not being fully optimized. And so for me, like I'm in the middle of this right now. I was supposed to do, I'm doing this series on the cardinal virtues. So I did the first two books and then the next book was supposed to come out this fall and it's more or less done. And then I would be starting just about now. I would be starting the fourth book in the series, and I made the decision to kick that whole process out a year. And weirdly, like I have been dealing with a whole bunch of sort of existential issues stemming from the fact that when I wake up in the morning, I don't have a thing that I have to be doing to hit a deadline that I've given myself, and there's a sort of an unmooredness to that like clearly at some point I felt when I was younger and really didn't like that feeling and built a life around not ever having that feeling. And that's not healthy either.
Yeah. I've always wondered if like, you know, I was, you know, people, you know, I always assumed, okay, if I dug into my why I self-defeat in this way, it must be some kind of like deep inner, you know, shame or self-esteem or something. And then I was thinking one day that I wonder if it's maybe the opposite, which is that I, maybe there's some kind of like feeling that most people develop from maybe from their parents' values of shame for not going outside all day or shame for not being productive. And that's like a stick that gets implanted in their head that hits them when they, you know, and they're scared of that stick. And maybe I lack that. Maybe it's like, so I don't know, but hearing you say that brings that thought back. Like, you know, maybe, you know, like your thing to overcome would be like you said with the wife in the pool, which is like, there's a dependency on the feeling that you're achieving something. There's some kind of emotional dependency there, which again serves you really well in so many ways. But it's interesting digging into like what that is.
Well, work for me, like sitting down and writing in the flow state of writing, is a wonderful feeling. It's very soothing, and it's more or less in my control. Right? Like the world is complicated. The world is unpredictable. The world is all of these things. But when I sit down and I have the material that I've researched, I get to move these things around at will. I get to live with these ideas and people and characters and concepts that I find very stimulating and meaningful. And, you know, I'm the master of my domain, right? I'm moving the words around on the page. I'm doing the thing that I'm really good at. I don't have to listen or do any other things. The volume on the inconveniences of life is turned down for that brief period. And so to not do that, either because I'm procrastinating or because I'm practicing self-restraint and I'm saying, hey, to do this sustainably over a long period of time, you have to pace yourself. There's distress in that. You're sort of willingly feeling a discomfort that's maybe akin to the discomfort you're feeling from actually concentrating.
But right, maybe we're both
at the core. I think as humans, we we try to stay in our comfort zone.
Right. So we're actually maybe just both avoiding suffering, and that it's like we're both doing the least yes. painful thing. Right. And so the question is, and I probably believe, you know, rather than try to, you know, it's like you can, if you want to change in life, you can do one of two things. You can try to go for suffering. What's the most sufferable thing? Let me do that and train yourself to be more masochistic in a way. Or you could try to reconfigure your psychology, reframe, change the way your schedule looks, change your reward structure such that you reconfigure what is the most suffering, right? So you can still, okay, let suffering be the rudder. That's fine, but I'm going to like change the direction of the wind or something, you know? So, yeah.
Well, it's like discipline for some people is like buckling down and doing the thing. And then discipline for other people is like taking your foot off the gas, right? And not doing something. And yeah. I'm probably more in that second category than the first category. I mean, there's definitely things where I'm not that way, but it's just sort of understanding like what is the harder thing for you? And then why is that the harder thing? And then do you have the resources or the willpower to go towards that thing? Because I think ideally you want to be in control, not your desires or your aversions. The Stoics would say that at the end of the day, those are the same thing, right? Like if you're repulsed by something or, overwhelmingly attracted to that thing, in either case, you're not really in control. Some deeper part
the
of
electromagnetic field, the electromagnetic field is driving you, your everything. Yeah.
Yes. And that's probably not good.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think I'm probably very, I'm very much like inside the electromagnetic field, and that's, I guess I was saying that there's two ways. You can go towards the suffering. You can try to reconfigure the field direction that, so it's pulling you, or I guess what the Stoics would say is no, you're not thinking big enough. You need to ascend above the electromagnetic field where it's not, now you're in control. Which is, that's really interesting. It could be hugely empowering, I imagine, if you can pull it off.
Well, I was just thinking about something you said though, about sort of building the muscle or having the experience with finishing projects, because I know you just became a parent, and one of my favorite Paul Graham essays, his kids are older, and he was talking about, you know, do you send them to college? How do you prepare them for the world? And he basically comes up with this idea that the most important thing you could give a kid are a series of projects, like things that they get really interested in, that they work on, and that becomes a microcosm of learning some of the lessons that we're talking about. So for one kid, maybe it's building model trains. For other kids, it's, you know, making the football team. You know, for other kids, it's learning a foreign language. But I am a big believer in the idea of having projects, because once you've done something, like you've built an audience, or you've written a book, or you've lost 200 pounds, or you've moved across the country, it doesn't matter what that thing is. If you've done stuff like that, then to me, that's the transferable skill, where you're like, I leapt off the ledge, I felt the terror of falling down, and then I built the airplane and I didn't crash, right? Like the ability to have that sort of, to see a process or a project all the way through, that's like the most valuable skill you can acquire as a person.
Because that's the evidence. Life is. That's the evidence you talked about, right? Like,
yes.
It is an interesting thing where when you haven't ever succeeded in something, whether you've tried it or not, even, it's something about our nature. It feels impossible, right? It feels like, that's one in a million, or it just takes so much luck or whatever. And there is, this is the Steve Jobs, quote about once you realize that the world around you is built by people no smarter than yourself, and you can get in there and you can push things, and something else falls out, and you can change the shape of things, your life is never the same again. It's this great epiphany, and I do believe that it's this a combo of, it's not necessarily that you realize that you're more powerful or you're more special than you are. It's that you realize that the world is not that awesome or impressive. And that any game you want to get in and try to win, the people who are currently winning it are They're just humans also. But the same amount of time you have, they have flaws also. You know, granted, there's hardware games and others. You want to, you know, be, you know, play in the Masters and win the, okay, you know, you're going to have to, you know, but even there, you know, it's like, I'm sure a lot of people that actually could have gotten there just give up right away. That's impossible. You have to be so lucky. And it's like, well, it's actually, these other guys are there and they're just humans. They were just a baby with a bottle at some point. And, you know, they're not magical. You know, great. If you want to be in the NBA, okay, you need a certain height or whatever. But really, for most things, I would just give, you know, our careers as an example. Like, there's a lot of people out there with a ton of insight. They observe things. They have interesting ways of thinking about things. Their friends love hearing their way of thinking because they're so interesting. And that person like has everything they need to go and suddenly be a big time, you know, writer, author, whatever kind of thing. And they just, they have this barrier, this where it feels like they just don't realize that it is totally doable. And so they don't even try it. So many people don't even try it in the first place. But that's why the Paul Graham thing makes sense. You're teaching a kid early. You put your mind to something. You move. You go in some ups and downs. You get experience going in the downs. And then, boom, look what happens at the end. You get there. Or you don't get there. And you realize that failing isn't it? Yeah, it's no big deal. Actually, it was kind of cool. It was kind of a fun experience. And, like, now you're excited. So it's either way, it's got to be so useful.
Yeah, I wrote about this in the Daily Dad a little bit. Like, everyone today is talking about this idea of Nepo babies, and we're sort of all very upset and outraged at it. I wonder how much of the Nepo baby thing, like, why do the children of successful people become successful in that chosen field? Obviously, there's genetic advantages. Obviously, there's relational advantages. But I wonder how much of it is, like, you saw your mom or dad do that thing, and it made it very humanizing to you. You're like, yeah, dad goes to work at an NBA arena, and that's a normal place to go to work. And there's a path to getting into that thing that isn't unattainable and crazy. Like, when I was growing up, none of my parents' friends didn't have jobs. Like, all my parents' friends had jobs. I didn't know a single entrepreneur. I didn't know a single creative person. So it wasn't until I went to college, and then I met people like professors and writers and stuff, and realized that these were just normal people, and that it was a job, not unlike being a school principal or having a construction company or something, that it's just a job, right? And so I think one of the things that, like, growing up, the child of a person who is in a path, an untraditional path like that, is it becomes a lot more familiar to you and thus a lot less intimidating. And that's actually the real advantage more than money or genetics.
Yeah, you're also just witnessing someone whose worldview is that society is my plaything. Society is my canvas. And like, yes. And I'm, you know, and like I have fun with it. I go and like I do my thing in society, as opposed to someone who's cowering before society and thinking like, you know, who's, sure, you know, the opposite of that attitude, I think, is someone whose parents, which is a lot of parents around me when I grew up, they're very into prestige. And, you know, prestige, yeah, is just another way of saying like you're getting a pat on the head from society. You know, you're treating society like this really important thing, big, scary thing to approve of you. And as opposed to thinking of society as my, like, my, you know, my playground. Now let's get out there, you know, mess around with it. And totally different way. And so if you're around this, you know, the vibe of society is big and scary, you're just going to absorb that. And you're going to have to override that. One of the ways I remember reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and it was like mind blowing. It was actually a terribly written book. And it's like, yes, you know, it's like run on sentences and it's like redundant. And it doesn't matter. The concept I had never heard. I was like 20. I remember reading it. And it was this idea that like, you can make money like by like just being creative and not having a job. And yes, it was like, it was just, you know, but it's, some people are just around that from the beginning. They're just, of course, and their parents are always Paul Graham's kids. Imagine like, yes, how ahead they are in this regard. They're just hearing from someone who's, you know, very wise in this. He's a great communicator, but B, he also, his business, you know, his life has been in turning, you know, make, you know, teaching people how to make society theirs. So yeah, I mean, it's absorbing. It's not just watching them go into the, you know, arena or whatever. But it's like just thinking, you absorb so much from your parents, just osmosis, just in. And I think, I grew up in a suburb where everyone's parents were lawyers, doctors, teachers, nothing else.
That's what I think is so funny about that college admission scandal, right? Like, these were all extremely rich, extremely powerful families, most of whom had become extraordinarily successful through untraditional paths, right? Entrepreneurial, creative, acting, whatever. And the message they were sending their kids is that actually all of that is totally worthless. At the end of the day, society is a set of rules. It's this fixed competition with a fixed number of spots available if you want to do something in life. And these spots are so valuable that we actually have to cheat to get them. But if we don't cheat to get them, you will be a loser and nothing will happen for you, right? Which is like the exact opposite of their lived experience. And I think there's an irony in that these people so wanted to secure advantages to their kids, like a degree from Harvard or, the networking that would come from this school or that school, when they already had given them the enormous advantage of showing them that the world is like flexible and malleable and you can make your own path. And they are like if you're a billionaire hedge fund manager, what kind of advantages networking wise do you think your kid is going to get at Harvard? Like, you can just introduce them to those people from your own life. Like the whole thing just struck me as such a weird commentary on how humans can abandon the very thing that made them successful in the first place.
Well, it goes back to, again, our wiring. It's really intuitive to humans to be inside whatever game is being played around them. And if there's those parents are talking to other parents and their kids went to here and their kids went here. And that's actually like, and they, you just, even though they have every reason to see this game is not what we should be playing. You just get sucked in.
It's
and,
not even real.
It reminds me of like, no, but okay. So I remember I was on a, I loved traveling alone. It's one of my favorite things. Just go on like a trip by myself and I meet people. And my this outgoing side of me comes out. That's never out in the US. And I made a ton of friends. I'm still in touch with them, whatever. So I go on this one thing. I was in some like canoe thing and like a two or three day thing in like the Amazon. And there's a group of other, backpackers there from like, I don't know where they're from, Britain, other places in Europe. And normally it's just I just make friends with a European backpacker. Right away we'd all be buddies, right? And I don't know whether I was being annoying or they weren't my type or they hate Americans or maybe it was in my head, but I felt outgrouped. It was like maybe, I think there was four or five of them. And I don't remember if they knew each other or not, but they weren't being very friendly. And so every part of my smart brain would say, well, all right, it's kind of interesting. Like, why are they being, I can dig into my book on this trip instead. I thought I was going to be hanging out. I'll never see them again either way. Like, cool. I'll go see, yet what happened was I got really upset about it. I found myself really like feeling, and I felt like I was in middle school and I felt like, and I was like, wishing they would be friendlier and invite me over to their, and I was like, what is this? This makes absolute, how am I suddenly upset about being outgrouped by four randos I will never see again who I just met? And it's just, the point is that's one of the games, of course, we are really susceptible to is the in-group, out-group, middle school game. This is, I think a lot of like political tribalism comes around, from this. It's like, as soon as that game is being played around us, it's like there's pheromones in the air and the dumb part of our brain wakes up and is like, I need to win this game. And it can't zoom out at all. And I feel like that's another version of what's happening here. When suddenly everyone around you, your worth as a family is about, did your kid go in, maybe you're a big movie star, but you're a dumb movie star, or do you have an actually smart family whose kid goes to, oh, suddenly I'm stuck in this game. And it's like, it just makes no sense at all. So you have to ask, like, what game am I right now caught up in that I don't even realize makes no sense to care about?
Yeah, this kind of relates to your thing about the mammoth, the woolly mammoth of caring what other people think. To be a person who didn't give a shit what other people thought for almost all of human history is a losing proposition. But in our artistic field, not caring what people think is how you break out, is how you do something unique. It's how you break through convention. It's very hard to turn off a piece of wiring that has been there since before we were even conscious of there being such a thing as that kind of wiring.
This is like comedians. Think about what does a successful comedian do? Obviously, they have a knack for comedy. That's a big thing. But the other a huge part of what they're doing is they realize that they find the things that everyone's thinking, but no one's saying, either because everyone's scared to say it, or sometimes just because everyone has that experience, but they don't realize it's universal. And so when someone else says it, they say, oh my God, I did that too. You know, and so what it is this ability to know what everyone's thinking that no one's saying, and understand that like no one's actually offended by it. Everyone just like thinks society thinks it's offensive, but it's not actually like actually. And then they go and say it out loud, and the audience is in stitches. They're so delighted that someone is saying this thing, and it just it's a reflection not on the comedian but on the audience. Like, what? Why are we all so delighted to hear that? Because we're all scared to say this thing. For some weird reason, because we're all in weird conformist people who are terrified of being different. It's...
Well, you know what's fascinating is we were talking earlier, like some people, discipline is doing stuff. And for some people, discipline is not doing stuff. What's interesting about the sort of nonconformity thing you just mentioned is that, and we both know some of these very successful, interesting people, like most people sort of think like everyone else. And so there is a skill in thinking not like everyone else, right? Of sort of pausing when you're on the side of the majority and thinking differently. And then I think what's been interesting the last couple of years is watching some of the people who are really good at thinking differently. And this is how they built multi-billion dollar fortunes or totally unique or interesting companies, to watch them struggle to grasp fairly obvious or straightforward or common sense things that the majority of the people have come to see. I guess what I'm saying is sometimes that nonconformist person actually has to have the ability to turn off that nonconformity because what they're disagreeing about is, say, the existence of gravity, or you know what I mean? Like they're outsmarting themselves, basically. Like the public is actually right here, or the consensus view is actually more or less correct here, and your contrarian thinking or your nonconformist thinking is actually getting you in trouble. And I don't mean trouble in the sense that some people disagree with you. It's just taken you further afield than you think you are, because you're running the same playbook that served you well in the past, but it's actually screwing with your bearings in this case.
Like an actual independent thinker, like, which is really hard to do. True, yes. Independent thinking, who's just, you know, it's not that you don't have, everyone has influences, but like you can observe and you can come and you can run with what you think. That person's going to sometimes come up with contrarian things that are going to shock everyone. And a lot of the other times they're going to come up with the thing everyone else has, because it's actually, it's not like the public's always wrong. And so what you're talking about is, you know, it's like when there's a contrarian position be taken, there's kind of two kinds of people taking it. There's the independent thinker who happens to have come there for this particular topic. And then there's the person whose identity is being contrarian, and who they're not actually independent. You know, that's not actually independent thinking. It's more independent than a total conformist, but it is actually like you're in your own prison, which is that I can never conform, because now my self-esteem is tied to being someone who doesn't conform. And that's not really great either. And you can, I think some people can start as the first kind and then get hooked on the feeling of, it's a lot more fun to be right when everyone's wrong than it is to, you know, be right when everyone's right. But if you real actual independent thinking, you have to continue to kind of remove prison walls that your mind's going to put up, because you're going to start to get like your ideas, or you're going to, you know, you're also going to get attached to your ideas that were really brilliant, but maybe times have changed and you have to, so it's a continual struggle to just push down the prison walls and kind of humble up and continue to be truly independent.
Yes. It's not just putting, I think Peter Thiel said this, it's not just putting a minus sign in front of what everyone else is thinking, because what if they're right?
Right. Yeah. And there's, it's in some ways you end up, I mean, this is a little different, but like I learned a little bit about the Flat Earth Society, which is real. And it's, you know, the people who there are, you know, at least when I checked last, there were 10,000 members and counting, and probably bigger now. And the what you find is that they don't just believe the Earth is flat. They also believe the moon landing was faked, and that JFK was an inside job, and that 9/11 was done by the Americans. And every single conspiracy that's out there, they believe, because right. they have a paranoid mindset that anything that the consensus believes is wrong, yeah. which of course. No one wants to be, that's not a good thinker, right? And so it's, and then of course, what you also find, and this is kind of a signal that something is wrong, is that people who are super contrarian, they end up with these pet theories though, and they become the opposite of the, they have almost like an overload of skepticism, but then they go flip the other way and go completely gullible when it comes to their pet theories. So the flat earther, you can bring them up in space and show them the Earth, and they'll say, this is a screen, or you've drugged me, or something. There's nothing, right? But as soon as you say, ships, you shouldn't be able to see them there if the Earth were round, and the fact that they don't do the math, they just say, see, there we go, more proof. Yeah. They just believe whatever they hear, right? So as you see a lot of that, is the same people who are uber contrarian are actually supremely gullible when it comes to things they do like.
Right, and because there is usually not a lot of good evidence for what they're talking about, when, a study that would otherwise be discredited or looked at weirdly or whatever, they need even the slightest veneer of sort of support or credentialism, right? So they'll jump all over, some weirdo academic that thinks the same way they do, even if in every other aspect that person is a crazy person. This happens, on all sides of the political spectrum, right? Like, you don't like the other side, so then somebody agrees with you that the other side sucks. You're willing to overlook a lot of things about that person because it buttresses your side of the argument, or it gives you some, appeal to authority that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Which isn't independent thinking. That's that your thinking settings are being configured based on the belief of the person you're hearing from. And so that your skepticism filter opens up wide, and then it goes super tight. And it's not being based on any kind of good metric. It's just on this thing. So you've been basically, and this happens to all of us, your mind, your thinking process has been captured by an ulterior motive, which is to believe this thing yes. and to not believe that thing. And you can't have two sacred motives. So if truth can be the sacred motive, but something in that case has come above truth, and now your settings all reconfigure around that sacred motive. So now suddenly believing this thing, proving this thing correct is now the sacred the sacred value, and that so that's not independent either. Actual independent thinking should not be that interesting a lot. The other person should say, "I don't know a ton," because unless it's something really straightforward, most things we just don't know that much as a species. There's not enough evidence, or there is, but you haven't put the time in to really dig into the evidence. So that's a sign of an independent thinker, is they're often, they don't have an opinion. They're saying, "I don't know." And someone who's, every opinion is really strong, there's a sign. There's some other proxy going on there for their beliefs.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So let me ask you about the new book, because one of the things I was interested in, we were talking about projects earlier, like how do you know you finish a project, you trust, you have the evidence, but you're 6 years into this project. It's taken so much longer than you thought. It's turned into a bunch of things, gone in a bunch of different directions that maybe you didn't think it would go. How did you know not to quit? Like, how did you know that you were heading in the right direction as opposed to, you know, stuck in a dead end?
I'm not sure I even knew it was the right direction as much as, well, first of all, there was just a lot of like silly human things like sunk cost fallacy. I don't know if I'm grown up enough to spend 4 years on a project and then throw it away. I just don't know if I can handle that. If I thought this thing was trash, and I was like, this thing is actually just not, it's not what I wanted to. Okay, I think in the end, that would win out. But like, if I think something has potential, a lot of times I've learned from blog posts, I'll put something out that I think is awesome and it doesn't really pop, and vice versa. I'll put something out that I think, oh, it's a cute thing. And then, wow, it went viral. Like, and so I also just thought this certainly qualifies as any of, as the quality of any of those other blog posts, some of which, you know, it surprised me. And so I felt it crossed the threshold where I was like, who knows? Let's put this out in the world and see what people think of it. This is, so I don't think it was some like, you know, fully binary thing. I think there would have been a pretty intense threshold to actually quit, because, you know, look, what I've been thinking about for 6 years, and here's all the tools that I've been using. And I did a lot of, you know, what I use Twitter for is so many of the images in the book, I would just tweet out. And it's a way to throw it against the wall and see if it sticks and just see how people react. So most of the things in there were pretty well tested. I'd run them by friends, and it was what I was thinking. And I was like, so if this is what I'm thinking, I don't have to, you know, I don't know whether people will resonate or not, but I want to, that's kind of what I do. I'll put out things I'm thinking. It's not an academic paper that has to have, you know, be replicated. It wasn't really much of a chance I was going to toss it. I did toss huge parts of it because it couldn't get that long, but, the hard part was just when to stop adding in new things, because I will never do a book on current events again. Maybe an article on current events, and I'll do books on universal topics, of evergreen topics. A book on current events is a nightmare, because you want to, you know, part of what makes it interesting. You know, if someone's writing a Substack on current events, it's great because the thing that happened yesterday, okay, here's what I think. Now imagine that Substack is a year delay. So it comes out in March of 24 about, or, you know, April 24 for something, and they're writing about this last week. No one wants to read them, right? So you have to, what, that's one of the things I didn't do print book for that reason. And I might do print on demand now, but I was like, if I don't do print, I can have this 1 month old only, versus a year old, which is just not a good plan, or not, maybe not a year, might've been 9 months old. And so the hard part was, you know, like I almost published this in 2020, and then George Floyd happens, and I'm writing about, you know, society politics. And it's like, it's just a seismic earthquake just happened in our society for lots of, you know, just one of those times when, you know, society's tectonic plates are pretty stubborn and movements try to move them and it's hard. And then something happens, whether it's a war or a giant protest, you know, movement or something, you know, a 9/11 was one of these. It's an earthquake. The plates are moving. You know, they're not going to be moving for long, maybe a couple months. And then they settle into a new stubborn equilibrium that might last 10 years. So the Bush administration said, boom, let's start a war right now. The mood plates are moving. All this opportunity is there for movements, for politicians in this one moment. And it's also a danger. It's a scary time. The plates are moving, sure. You know, all the rules, you know, desperate times, desperate measures, things go crazy. So anyway, there'd be things like that when I'd see an earthquake. And I'm like, well, the book has to, I can't have the book come out, the pre-earthquake book come out post-earthquake. So anyway, I finally decided, you know, things are going to keep moving, and that's okay. And I just need to publish. And so I just finally you know, and it's, you know, it's hard. It's hard finishing because I had to cut a lot, and cutting is nightmarish. And, but yes, finally it got out, and I think I feel good about the timing. I feel like, okay, it was, and still, I believe, is an expression of the current moment. Maybe in a year, it'll now be feel like a little dated. Right now, it feels like it's still on point.
That is a weird thing that you learn. I think, who is the screenwriter? I'm forgetting his name, but there's a great William Goldman. He said, you know, nobody knows anything, right? Nobody knows anything about what is or isn't going to work. And one of the things you learn putting stuff out there is that some of the things you had the most doubts about turned out to be fantastic and people loved them. And the thing you were most certain about didn't work at all. And there's some freedom in that, but it's also disorienting because now you don't know whether to trust your own doubts. Like I relate to what you're just saying is like when I published Daily Stoic, I remember I sent it to my editor and I was like, this is like, it was all designed. It was all ready to go. I was like, can you look at this one last time? I don't think we should publish this. I was like, I'm not sure this is good enough to publish. It came together too quickly, too easily. I'm just not sure this is the right career decision for me. And, you know, that book changed my life. It sold 2 million copies. It's in all these different languages. It's been incredible. But like, I try to remind myself all the time that like literally days before publication, I was like 51-49 not publishing it. And that's helpful, but it also, I guess it could also be dangerous because what if there was actually something I shouldn't publish and now I'm like, oh, I'm going to hit publish because last time I thought that it turned out I was just having cold feet. So it's a weird feeling when you realize that you don't really know anything.
Yeah, but I think that I think that the best way you can do your thing in your one life and contribute is, unless it seems really bad, throw it out there. And by the way, you might not, something might, you know, sell one tenth of that, but it really impacts the people who love it, right? Maybe sometimes sure, it's like a cult classic. It doesn't go viral, but it's deeply beloved by the people. I have a few posts like that, which are the ones that I feel like the super fans talk about, always reference, but they're not actually, they didn't do very well. And like, you know, as far as numbers, and then other ones that were mega viral that I've never heard like an actual like, you know, big time Wait But Why reader mention, because it's just not really, you know. So I think there's, you know, there's if you put time into it, you know, there's something in there that someone will love. But I also like to think about the Beatles. Like, they put out 200 songs about, and 100 of them are bad. I don't think people realize how. There's a great, I think it's Vanity Fair article. That goes, or maybe it's Vulture. It goes through 200 ranking the Beatles songs from worst to best, and this guy's in mind. But he's a really big Beatles fan, big music person, and it's amazing how long you have to go before you've heard of the songs. Like, you know, they wrote a lot of just bad, forgettable songs, and right, it's really like their top 70. Their top 70 were good, and it's really, and what made them the Beatles was like their top 20 or 30 were amazing, but they put out 200 to find those. And so I feel like the best thing, you know, if you take the big zoom out, it's like, you know, rather than obsess over which finished projects are, put them all out, rough and dirty, make a new one. Don't be a perfectionist, make stuff, put it out. And you never know when you just strike magic and it's the right thing at the right time. And I think that is kind of the mentality. And this is, you know, and I say this as someone who regularly starts a blog post and then says nah and goes the other way. But I think you're remembered for your hits, you know, and you've got to give yourself a lot of swings at the bat, to get those. Which is, by the way, part of why I hate doing a 6-year project. A 6-year project blows. Because it's taking a 6-year swing of the bat. Well, it's also just like, I don't want to take it. I don't have enough time to take any 6-year swings. It doesn't matter what it is, you know? And so it's like, I feel like that's, I should have a, you know, 1-year limit on future projects, maybe two.
Well, quantity is a way to get to quality. And that's really hard if you're a perfectionist or you have high standards. The idea that you have to accept that objectively a good chunk of your stuff is not only not going to be as good as your other stuff, it might not be good at all. That is a hard bit of acceptance and realism that you have to come to terms with. Or just to think, I mean, like Bill Belichick has lost a lot of Super Bowls, right? Like that.
Yeah.
Like you tend to focus on when it works.
Public failures.
Yes. Yeah. Like, but ultimately the only way you can win a Super Bowl is by taking a trip to the Super Bowl, right? And so if you focus more on like sort of getting in the ballpark, and you get in the ballpark a number of times, chances are, you know, you're going to walk away with whatever that metric of success is if you do that often enough.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, if your general average work is good, right? If you're putting out 10 bad things in a row, well, now you're going to lose people's trust. But then you probably, honestly, then you might not be, I mean, it depends. If you're really early, then you might have a long way, a lot of growth left. But if you're just, you know, if you've been doing this for a long time and you put a 10, maybe you need to adjust what the medium or whatever. But the point is, if you're having a hit, you know, here and there, and most things are, you know, a lot of things are pretty well liked, some things are, then you should just pump it out as long as your average is pretty good, because you're going to hit, yes, get some hits along the way, and then the bad things won't be the norm. And so screw it, like, put that up, you know. And I think it is actually a superpower, yes, to not be terrified of having a flop. You know, I have a friend who is a stand-up comedian, and one of the things he did early is he just went out there and intentionally bombed. He just went out there and just made just really stupid jokes and long pauses, and people eventually were booing. And he just said, I want to feel it and realize the sky didn't fall on me, and now I can just relax. And it's kind of a superpower, I think, to accept that some of the things are going to be bad, and that's totally okay.
Yeah, I think about it, it's like, as long as you're making contact with the ball, that's what you want, right? Sometimes it's going to go far over the back wall. Sometimes it's going to go high up in the air and someone's going to catch it, right? Sometimes it's going to go foul. But the important thing is that you're making contact with the ball consistently.
Yeah.
And if that's how you're judging success, you know, you're going to hit you're also going to probably have a number of home runs to show for that. To go to what your comedian friend is talking about, if you're also aware that the worst thing that can happen is that you strike out, or the worst thing that can happen is people are bored or they laugh at you or you get fired, you realize that that's not so bad either. So you're sort of open to the upside, but you've capped the downside. That's like the ultimate, you know, position to be operating from.
You have to be able to, the human superpower is to realize that embarrassment isn't that big a deal. Because we really hate being embarrassed, publicly embarrassed. And, you know, doing something publicly, putting it out there, your art, your work, your thoughts, and people don't like it. It gets made fun of, whatever. People are writing mean comments. It's, you know, people in your life, your friends and family are seeing those, right? Everyone you know is seeing. Yes. It's a little embarrassing. It feels bad, right? And then you step back and realize, like, I'm a writer. My job is to put myself out there. This is going to happen. It's going to happen. And especially, yes, if I'm trying to be bold and do different things. And also, like, if other people are seeing it, I don't care. Like, it's like, it's like, it's part of a much bigger picture. And it's this amazing thing to realize, like, yeah, it feels bad. But like, there's so many people who do everything in their power. Number one priority is make sure that never happens. Make sure they're not publicly embarrassed, yes, ever. Publicly, they don't look bad publicly ever. They don't look like they made a mistake publicly. I mean, it's like, that is such a limiting thing.
Yeah, I think self-consciousness is the enemy, right? Because it's the opposite of being present. It's usually rooted in fear or like a sort of a thirstiness, like you really want validation or approval or a certain thing to happen. It's very outcome dependent. The best position is where you're not thinking about that shit at all. You're just thinking about what you're trying to do.
You know, I one thing I've done that's been very... One of the wise things I do is when I get a flat tire or a fender bender, or I twist my ankle and need to, you know, be on crutches, when it's something really annoying, and I'm like, wow, I still have to do all the things I had to do on my list, and now I also have this thing, right? It's so easy to just be like, the world has wronged me. This is now, I can't believe this, and like, Or you can say 5 to 10 of these things happen every year. It is 100% 5 to 10 of these things. I just got one out of the way. Oh, here we go. Yes. Yeah, here's one of those 5 to 10. Here it is. I didn't know what was going to happen today, but there's the flat tire at 2 a.m. And it's just, once you have that, you suddenly shrug. You put on a podcast and start changing your tire, or you're waiting for AAA and it happens. Oh, I got one out of the way. So you can apply this as well to, I put out a blog post and it's just being hated on, right? Oh my God, on Reddit, they hate me. This, oh, as a writer, you think I'm going to go through a writing career and not have 20 or 30 of these? Oh, here's one, getting it out of the way. So that zoom out and understanding the inevitability of this thing totally takes the sting away, because it doesn't feel like something bad happened. I fucked up. I made like I wish I could go. It's like, well, yeah, but like I'm going to fuck up and that's okay. And so it's kind of baked in, and then you don't care nearly as much.
Well, there's a passage in Meditations where Marcus Aurelius talks about this in regards to people. He goes like, look, is a world without assholes possible? He's like, no, obviously not. And then he's like, so when you meet an asshole, say to yourself, this is one of those people. This is one of that number, right? I was never, it was statistically certain that I would bump into this person. It was unavoidable. By the way, they're a minority. I know this statistically also. And, now that I know, now that I didn't, because I wasn't telling myself that this was impossible or even unlikely, I'm not only less surprised, I get to say what you said, which is, okay, I've met one out of the 100, and now it's probably going to be a little while before I bump into the next one of these people.
You also don't take it personally, because you think this person has been being an asshole to everyone, not just me. And it's the same thing with, by the way, I'm a real troll in the comment section. Sometimes you can click on their thing and see what other comments they've been making, right? On Reddit or on Discuss, on WordPress. And so often, oh, they're shit-talking 10 blogs right now, right? And then you suddenly don't care anymore, because you say, this isn't about me. One of these people passed through, you know, and they're shit, you know, they got shit on this, like they got shit. It's not like, oh my God, why would I engage? It's nothing to do with me. It's nothing to, you know, and you just, yeah, again, that all you're doing is.
And even to say to yourself, this person is doing their job. Right. This person is a troll. This person is an asshole. That's their role out of 100 people. Why would I expect them to be anything other than whatever they were apparently assigned by circumstances or their personality or whatever? This is what they do. And then you say to yourself, my job is to not be an asshole. Right. So when I'm being an asshole, I'm neglecting my responsibilities. And when I'm being nice and when I'm being good and when I'm not treating people terribly, that's me fulfilling my job on this planet. And if we can kind of see people as being assigned to these roles, it does allow us to be, I think, a bit more accepting of the fact that they're not always going to be and do what we want them to do.
And get rid of that, like this feeling, this inane feeling that like, I need to show them that they're wrong. I need to punish them. I need to like come back with a snappy retort. And it's like, no, I don't. That is not the point here. That's not the goal with this person. And then what you're letting them do is do something much worse than be an asshole. You're letting them become an asshole whirlpool that pulls other people into it. Now they're all acting like assholes. You're letting them spread the thing. It's like, no. Quarantine the assholeness in that one person by shrugging and saying, I guess this person is that person who's an asshole.
Yeah, don't let the son of a bitches turn you into a son of a bitch, I sometimes say.
Yeah. So Twitter is really good at doing that, which is part of the problem. I think, it's just funny when you meet people. I'm sure you've experienced this, where you've gotten, you know, negativity online, and then you meet people in person who know your stuff, and just like, it's even people who don't, like, you know, it's just everyone is so civil and so kind and nice and normal in person.
I'm not sure I've ever met someone who doesn't like my work in person. Like, I'm sure they exist, but no one has ever told me to my face, that I suck. The worst thing I've heard in person pales in comparison to what I hear online every single day.
Of course. Or the people will be gentle about it. They'll say, I really, really like your stuff. You know, did you ever consider, you know, this aspect of it? Because I know I feel like, you know, maybe you skipped over that a little bit, blah, blah, blah. You know, and online they're saying, you know, oh, this really shows the type of person that Tim is, you know, just this, you know, personal nasty. And it's, you know, it's the same, you know, there's, I'm sure some of those, you know, it's, there's something about, being online that just, because a lot of what we've been talking about in this whole conversation is the dichotomy from what our stupid brains get full fall for. And then when you can zoom out and see the truth, the real thing, what our smart part of our brains can see is real. And so this is another example where it's just like, there's something about being online when it's hard to, when you can just fall for the fact that this is, you can think this is a non-human who is not a real person with, and then in person, like you're forced to zoom out and say, oh, this is a complete human being. Here they are. Plus there's just social etiquette. Like it takes a lot more courage to be a dick in person than it does behind the screen.
Well, no, I think the new book is a great meditation on what happens when that is happening on the societal level. I like the idea of a self-help book for the world. Like what do we collectively have to be thinking about in terms of our collective values or traits if we don't want to blow ourselves up or destroy each other? And I think it's very well done. And I'm sorry it took 6 years, but I'm also glad that it finally came out.
Yeah, never again, but I'm happy it's done.
Well, that's perfect. Let's not have that be the rule for the podcast. And when you come out to Austin sometime, let's do it again in person.
Agreed. Would love to.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.